This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Furtke, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of October 16th, here are a few top stories. In the news this week, we began our State of Aging in the Valley series. Here's one of the stories. For people diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, short-term memory fades first. While this may not seem like the best time in a person's life to start learning a new skill, researchers at the Mayo Clinic are realizing that learning is not only possible, it could also have long-term benefits for patients as their dementia progresses. From the KJZZ Education Desk, Carrie Young reports.
Anne and John Avart have been married for 22 years, but John remembers the day they met in Dublin, Ireland, like it was yesterday. They were at a friend's house and...
in walked this good-looking blue-eyed doll, and all of a sudden, I used my best male voice to say, "Well, hello, how are you?"
Old memories like this are easy for Avart to recall, but it's new memories, like what he ate for dinner last night, or if he went to his appointments at the VA, that just aren't sticking these days.
I was diagnosed with an MRI that my brain has shrunk a little bit, has gotten some white spots, I think they call them.
Avart has something known as mild cognitive impairment, which is a very early stage of Alzheimer's. He says the diagnosis was scary at first, but lately he's been finding success with a new program aimed at making the most of his procedural memory, which uses a different part of the brain, one that stays healthier for longer as dementia progresses.
We're not asking them to learn a new list of facts. We're asking them to learn a new process.
That's Donna Locke, a psychologist at the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale. She says a new program there called Habit is trying to do just that, create new habits in their patients with mild cognitive impairment.
This is procedural memory, and that's a different type of neuroanatomical network than our short-term memory system.
Locke explains that her team trains small groups of patients and their caregivers to develop habits that promote self-sufficiency and overall health. The goal is to help patients stay more independent for longer. The sessions at Mayo include things like diet and exercise plans, and it even helps patients make time for brain games. But for Locke's team, the most important habit they're trying to create is to learn to effectively use a written agenda and calendar.
Do you have any appointments next Monday?
I joined Avart and Locke for one of their recent training sessions. Locke says repetition is key when it comes to making action stick and turn into habits.
What do you have going on this weekend?
Boy. Dinner with the neighbors on Saturday evening.
Locke says she hopes that eventually when Avart or many of her patients with mild cognitive impairment doesn't know the answer to a scheduling question, they'll do something like this.
For a moment, they might think, oh gosh, how am I going to answer this question? But their hand is reaching for that pocket to pull out that book. That's what the procedural memory system that we need to kick into place does for them, is that it helps them kind of do this automatic, I'm going to pull here.
And while Locke's team hasn't yet researched whether habit development like this can have meaningful physiological impacts in slowing the onset of dementia, they are seeing gains in patient and caregiver happiness and quality of life, something Avart's wife, Anne, says she can attest to.
It has taken a lot of stress off me, or maybe stress is the wrong word, maybe just frustration, a little irritability, oh, come on. Do I have to answer every question? Now, I hardly ever have to answer a question. He just checks. He's become much more independent.
She says that independence is important right now because she and John would like to continue their more social habits, like dancing, which is one of their favorites.
At our ages, it is slow dancing.
Anything that has a smooch in it.
For Anne and John, it's their old and new skills alike that are helping them to live in the moment each day, because they say they just don't know what the future holds. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
You can find much more on the series at aging.kjzz.org. And this is KJZZ's Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Music fans in Phoenix have a big weekend in store. Tens of thousands of people will flock to the Lost Lake Festival, which promises 3 days of music, food, and art. Many believe the festival marks the arrival of Phoenix onto the national scene. KJZZ's Will Stone reports.
Chicago has Lollapalooza, New York, the Governor's Ball, Austin, South by Southwest. And now?
That's what we're doing here in Phoenix. We're bringing something of that quality, but a localized version to this market.
A market that Rick Farman, one of the producers of the Lost Lake Festival, believes is hungry for the kind of musical blowout that has become a staple for many a millennial.
Everyone comes to have a good time, and it's just good, loving people.
It is a home. You're best friends with everybody. We're a family now. That's all a part of the experience.
The promo video for Lost Lake glides slowly over Phoenix's Steele Indian School Park, overlaid with graphics of three stages, a lava pit and playground, a brew park, and more. Farman explains the concept as he walks through the soon-to-be-transformed festival grounds.
It's not somewhere where you come and just sit at one stage for hours and hours. It's really an immersive experience where you experience lots of different things throughout the day and the weekend.
Farman's company, Superfly, knows how to pull this off. It produces Bonnaroo near Nashville and Outside Lands in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park. For Lost Lake, they're pulling in more than 40 acts, headliners like The Killers, like you imagine when you were young. Chance the Rapper, and The Pixies. But talk to Farman and you hear less about the lineup and more about local.
Our goal here is to, you know, be a showcase for the artists, be a showcase for the restaurants, be a showcase for everybody that's creating stuff, taking all the amazing elements of the Phoenix and the Valley area and using a festival to sort of express all of those things.
That expression will take many forms. Local artists painting giant panels, dozens of nearby restaurants offering food curated by Chef Chris Bianco, a play area hosted by the Phoenix Children's Museum, and...
We will have some of our art cars here, so Walter and Heathen, Big Red, Pugbug.
That's Kirk Strawn, who runs Walter Productions, a Burning Man-inspired entertainment company with a fleet of art cars based in Phoenix.
One of those actually will be shooting fire on it, and then the lake is another surprise.
Strawn's company has done similar things at Bonnaroo and calls Lost Lake a turn of the page for Phoenix.
It really brings in this level of event, and we just don't have anything that's like that.
Lost Lake is getting a lot of hype, in part because it's linked up with local promoters and venues. Even Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton is making the pitch.
I want to see you there in big numbers because we've never done a big three-day festival like this, and I'm proud of it, and it's going to be great in our city.
We've had festivals.
Ed Masley covers music for the Arizona Republic.
It's a different type of festival. It's outside promoters. It's the Bonnaroo people. I think it's great that they're coming in. I think it means great things for Phoenix. But I think there's a tendency to diminish what we already have.
There's Pot of Gold and Chandler, Viva Phoenix, and the McDowell Mountain Music Festival, to name a few. Still, Lost Lake does represent a vote of confidence in Phoenix, and probably not just for 1 year, says Biasha Mitchell, who heads up music festival strategy at Eventbrite. We spoke via Skype.
It is a very, very rare festival that is profitable in the first even 1, 2, or even 3 years. It is really something you have to build year over year.
Mitchell says their research from 2016 shows that the vast majority of festival goers plan to go to the same amount, if not more, this year.
So that to us indicates that there is at least the same amount of demand, if not more, year over year.
The number one decider for the prospective festival goer? The headliner, Mitchell says.
Getting someone to buy that ticket, you know, it's a challenge and you have to actually book those national acts. And then once they actually come through your doors, it's really about the food, the art installations, the rest of these things that will actually make someone feel like, oh, wow, this festival gets me.
Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And now from KJZZ's The Show, let's take a few minutes now to get out there. Here's Steve Goldstein.
Most of us will never actually be in space, let alone spend 7 months on the International Space Station. And our only opportunity to experience the visual components is through photographs. NASA astronaut Terry Virts has not only done 2 stints on the space station, he's also an accomplished photographer. Tonight at 7:30 at the Mesa Arts Center, as part of the National Geographic Live speaker series, Virts will present View from Above. It includes many of the photos he took from the space station. And Terry Virts is with me. Terry, can you describe what it feels like to be on the International Space Station? Are there certain words or emotions that come to mind?
There's a lot. It can be overwhelming. It's a little bit euphoric, and you have to talk yourself into, okay, just this is amazing, let's get back to work. You have to kind of calm your mental state down because it's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm seeing the Earth. So there's the view of the Earth, and then there's the feeling of weightlessness that is an entirely alien feeling. Unless you've jumped off. They used to make these things called diving boards. You know, you could jump off a diving board and you'd have a second before you hit the water. But, or if you're a pilot, you can push forward on a stick and you get a few seconds of weightlessness, but then it ends. And in space, when the engine shut down, somebody turns on the weightlessness switch and it does not end. In my case, it was 200 days on my most recent mission. So you really have to learn, there's an urge to flail your arms. So you have to mentally tell yourself, don't flail your arms. There's an urge, or there's like a confusion about how to move from A to B, because you're not used to walking with your hands and pushing off and floating. Everything is alien about weightlessness. So there's the combined, I can't believe what I'm seeing, and then the sensation of weightlessness. It takes a little bit of time, you know, days and weeks before you're really good at what you're doing up there.
And when it comes to the weightlessness part of it, do you grow to like it or just adjust enough to make it work?
Love it. I just love it. The first, my first 2 days on my very first flight, I had a raging headache. I mean, I was taking ibuprofen. It was really, that's a common astronaut experience. Your head hurts. There's a lot of fluid in your head. Your vestibular system, you know, your balance system is completely messed up. I was like, oh, this sucks. And then on the morning of my third day in space, it was like a light switch went on. And all of a sudden, boom, I felt great. And then I just had a giant smile on my face for the rest of my 2 week space shuttle flight. And when I went up on my second flight, my body, it was like, I know where I'm at. And I didn't have that same headache kind of dizziness that I had on the first flight. It was weird. My body had learned that. And for some reason, that experience stayed stuck in my brain, and it adapted to weightlessness much quicker.
So what is it like readjusting to the Earth? How long does that take?
President Obama asked me the same question after my first flight. So after my first flight, the first day, I felt really heavy, like lifting small things were just super heavy in my perception. When I pulled the blanket over me in the bed, it felt like a big lead, like at the dentist office, the lead blanket you have to wear for x-rays. It felt like that on me. Everything was just heavy. On my second flight, I especially noticed dizziness. I mean, I was able to walk around. I was able to stand up and sit down and do all this stuff immediately after landing, after 200 days in weightlessness. I just didn't like it, and I hated it, and I was really dizzy.
For people who have done what you have done, there's obviously a small club. Does it feel like it's kind of inexplicable in some ways to people who try to talk to you about it?
I had seen a million astronaut photographs. I talked to astronauts. I'd been in the astronaut office for over 9 years when I first finally flew. It took a long time to get a flight, and I finally got a flight. And I can remember the very first time I saw the very first sunrise. We were going over the North Atlantic after a 4 a.m. flight. A few minutes later, we're in the sunrise, and I saw this beautiful, intense, bright, deep blue sunrise. And I thought, I can still remember this thought, I've never seen that shade of blue before. And it was surprising because I had seen all these pictures and I'm like, how am I seeing something I've never seen before? So the pictures are great, but you could see pictures of the Grand Canyon too. But when you go there and you walk out to the edge and you see this, like, wow, or desert, you see a picture of a cactus. But when you go to the desert and, you know, maybe it just rained and it has that desert smell and there's wind and you can see everything. So the experience of being there was really orders of magnitude. Even though the pictures are great, it was still even more than the pictures.
So the richness of these photos, which are extremely rich, doesn't even compare. So you're saying that it actually looks even more amazing than that.
It does. It's not even close. So on a spacewalk, 99% of my spacewalks were just work, work, work. And I can remember one time I had like a second. So I stopped and I rotated myself out and I was watching this sunrise. It was just unbelievable. And the helmet outside, you can basically see everything. There's very little blocking your peripheral vision. On the inside, there's always like window bars or there's always something blocking you, even though not too much. And to see the sunrise with nothing blocking it, I remember it was like I was hearing God say, I am. It was this amazing experience. And then back to work because I got something else to do, you know. Sublime and mundane just juxtaposed constantly for my entire 7 months in space.
That sounds like discipline to me too, though, where you see this amazing thing most of us will never see, and then, oh, wait, all of a sudden I've got to go back to fixing this particular thing.
Yeah, it requires discipline. I mean, I enjoy art. Like, I love Impressionism, and I'm probably the weird technical guy that appreciates artistic things too. And so it was in my nature to be captivated and want to take pictures and go, wow, but there's this clock, this mental alarm clock going off in my brain going, you got to get back to work. And
NASA astronaut Terry Virts will be at the Mesa Arts Center tonight at 7:30 presenting View from Above. It's part of the National Geographic Live Speaker Series. He also has a new book of the same name. Terry, thanks very much for the conversation.
Looking for being back to where I learned how to fly almost 30 years ago.
Wow, really? Fantastic.
At Williams Field, yep.
Terrific.
Thanks.
Thanks, man. Bye-bye.
Arizona's wildfire season burned all across the Coronado National Forest, destroying the habitat of one of the state's most endangered species. KJZZ's Lillian Donahue reports.
Over the summer, the Fry Fire charred more than 48,000 acres in southeastern Arizona, destroying nearly half of the small yet crucial habitat that hosts Arizona's endangered mountain gram red squirrel. An annual survey estimated that the endangered species dropped from 252 squirrels to about 35 over the past year. James Driscoll with the Arizona Game and Fish Department says the squirrels are just one of many local species that face habitat degradation.
You know, you're going from an animal that might have a forest habitat niche down to something that now looks like a moonscape. Well, then, yeah, absolutely, there's going to be effects to wildlife and the habitats, you know, from the game species to the non-game species.
He also says other environmental concerns like climate change and drought have already impacted the habitats of many Arizona animals. Lillian Donahue, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Thanks for listening to KJZZ, and this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Finally this week from KJZZ's Fronteras desk, an Arizona state senator says the Phoenix Police Department's recently revised immigration enforcement policy violates SB 1070. Per another state law, the Arizona Attorney General has had a month to investigate if it does. From the Fronteras desk, KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports.
I asked Phoenix police to see their revised immigration enforcement policy in action, but the department does not do ride-alongs. So Sergeant Jonathan Howard let me come to headquarters, and we spent about an hour in a conference room randomly sifting through a pool of roughly 10,000 body cam videos. In one video, officers respond to a report of a suspicious person. The woman who called police doesn't speak much English. She tells them the estranged father of her children had called saying he was coming to pick up the kids. The officers tell the woman how to get a restraining order and then leave. They don't ask about her immigration status.
It would be very unlikely that something like that would come up. Unless it led to an arrest situation, certainly, and then it would be a requirement under state law.
Police are so busy they don't have time to enforce immigration law, says Ken Crane, president of the Phoenix Law Enforcement Association, or PLEA. He calls the policy revision a solution in search of a problem.
Even though the policy's changed, it hasn't really impacted how we're doing police work. But what it does, by gutting the policy, it prohibits officers in situations where they may need the tools of not having them.
When the mayor of Phoenix slammed President Trump's executive order expanding immigration enforcement priorities, Crane sent a strongly worded open letter to City Hall.
We've had police officers over the years, numerous police officers just on Phoenix, that have been killed and injured by people that should have never even been in the country to begin with.
Crane says PLEA was not invited to work on revising the immigration enforcement policy, and the update may have been retaliation for his letter.
Let me put it this way. It feels that way. Can I prove that? No.
The ACLU of Arizona did work on the revision. Will Gaona is the group's policy director. He says the department needs to make sure officers get guidance on when and where to enforce immigration law.
You know, I think this is a policy that was designed to help protect victims and witnesses of crime, children in schools, and things like that. And so I certainly hope the department's taking these changes seriously.
Similar policies have been in place for years in Tucson and other cities, Gaona says.
Phoenix didn't just make this up. They looked around the state, collected best practices, and updated their policy in a way that's designed to both promote community trust while fully implementing and enforcing SB 1070.
Since the revision is just a policy, Gaona says the Attorney General does not have authority to investigate it. But more broadly speaking,
included in SB 1070 is a mandate that it be implemented in a way that protects the civil rights of all people. What Phoenix has done here is just try to protect people's civil rights.
Now it's up to Attorney General Mark Brnovich to decide if the Phoenix Police Department's revised immigration enforcement policy breaks or upholds SB 1070. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Katherine Fritke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.